Hello, welcome back to Sports Unlocked with me, Rob Harris from Sky News, Martin Ziegler from The Times, Tariq Panja from The New York Times, and so much to get into the world of FIFA, the IOC, a really heavy news week as ever.
A lot of hard news week as well. There's only one place to start, the hardest man in sports news in Tunisia. Rob, what were you doing?
Unexpected of stories, this, ending up in the Tunisian Sun, running with Ross Cook. If you don't know, the self-styled hardest geezer completing a run the length of Africa from the southern tip to the northern tip. So I was there on the final day in Tunisia, didn't quite know what to expect or how many people would even be interested in this thing.
I mean, the video footage shows exactly what happened. The hardest geezer at the end of 10,000 miles or whatever and 350 days of consecutive marathons, he was always pipped to the post by you, Rob. You were like sprinting. And you go, at one point, I thought you were going to cross the finish line before him. But I mean, credit to you. Not only did you slow down, but you amazingly were able to keep like talking about, you know, commentating and speaking into the microphone while running, which from, you know, people who I know who are sort of experts, that is a very difficult thing to do.
Hang on. Not only keeping up and running, from what you were wearing a black shirt and some trousers, and you were keeping up with him. And also, congratulations for avoiding a blooper, because I was just waiting for you to go face down into the turf there. So, well done, Rob.
The backstory to the clothing: jeans, blue shirt, always good to wear in heat, and boots, because I'd actually been there at the tip of Africa the previous day. We'd been doing some filming, so I knew it was pretty rocky terrain. This was not a smooth beach he was going to finish on. And also, you didn't quite know what to expect, when he was exactly going to come. And then when he sort of came by me, I thought, I've got to keep up with him because I need to describe what's going on here live. So before you know it, you're running. But I'd already had one run with him right at the start of the day, where we were in this remote part of northern Tunisia, like middle of nowhere, it seemed, a town of about 5,000 people. Amazingly, dozens of runners had come from England and other places to join him on this final run. And we weren't quite know when he'd arrive. Suddenly he arrived, started speaking to him on camera. And then he suddenly said, well, should we get running? And I'm thinking, well, I've got to try and keep up with him. We've got to try and film him, camera operator running backwards. And somehow we end up doing an interview while on the run at the start of this final leg, which is going out live all around the world. I do eventually stop thinking, he doesn't want to keep talking while he's got to run. And camera operator getting pretty tired too.
Just a word on your camera operator. Was he running backwards during that whole, you know, several minutes?
He was, and none of this was planned at all. We hadn't sort of known what the choreography of this sort of start would be, and it was so chaotic in the end. And yeah, it was in the morning heat as well, and I didn't think the locals knew what hit them in this area.
Yeah, it was good TV. And it did, Ziggs, did it remind you a little bit, you know, when you've seen Rocky, when he's doing that training and all these people start joining him up the steps of, is it the Philadelphia Municipal Building? Kind of felt like that, but it was all like lads from England in Tunisia.
Exactly. Lads from, you know, runners, you know, fell runners wearing England shirts, that sort of thing. But it was brilliant. And the hardest geezer, he celebrated with a strawberry daiquiri and a throne at the end. So how did you celebrate, Rob?
I did briefly get into the after party, as it were, very much later on after we'd done all the Nesso parts of the job. I think he'd gone to finally sleep at that point. Something really interesting, though, I heard, though, when you've been running the equivalent of more than a marathon a day for a year, apparently you can't just stop. You've got to keep it up in some form for your body's health.
So what, he had to go for a run, like, for the next few days?
Well, he's back in England now, and what I heard, he has to keep running in some form. You've got to sort of gradually ease yourself off it.
And Rob, this is a sports news podcast, so I'm going to have to ask, is he the first man to run the length of Africa? There was some controversy, wasn't there?
Intriguingly, this World Runners Association, a post emerged, claiming that someone else had done it. Was it a Danish guy?
Danish guy, yeah.
Yeah, but it looked like, well, he'd started from Egypt and finished at a more northerly point than South Africa. So it wasn't from the most southerly point to the most northerly point, or the other way around. So it was the tip to tip. And he had to go around the West Coast as well to avoid wars and all sorts of border issues and conflicts and political strife as well, did Ross Cook, who, if it wasn't clear, he is from southern England, by the way, for those listening all around the world. 27 years old.
Yeah, it is amazing how the sort of story gripped everybody. But I mean, I think before it sort of became mainstream news, he'd already become a sort of cult figure with younger people, and you know, very much a sort of social media phenomenon. But it sort of was seized upon really by the sort of wider sporting and media world.
And here's the thing, particularly for some of those comms people who always think we're after negatives. If a positive story has a really good edge to it, it can engage, it can be thrilling, and it can be something that excites the story as much as, you know, some of those more questionable and transparency-based stories as well, where it's sort of holding people to account. You can have a bit of light and shade.
Yeah, and, well, you mentioned one of those organisations. You saw the IOC, Rob. They jumped on that. I saw a big picture of you and the chap who ran the length of Africa. You featured in an IOC post this week.
I was very surprised to feature on the At Olympics post in some form of running. It was not something ever expected that I would qualify in some small way to feature on the Olympics count running. But maybe I'm in for some cash.
Well, yes, because Sebco, World Athletics President, put the cat among the pigeons this week. He has said that gold medalists at the Olympics in athletics will get $50,000. This is the first time there's ever been sort of cash payments for an Olympic winner. Some people might say this sort of strikes at the sort of heart of the Olympic ideal. And certainly it seems to me that there is a sort of political agenda here, because Coe wants to be the IOC president. Thomas Black wants to stop him becoming the IOC president. So is this shots fired, Tarek?
The cash amongst the pigeons.
Ah, good.
Yeah. A lot of people have taken it that way. There's no love lost between Thomas Black and Seb Coe. And this is an area of differentiation. I'm sure athletes would love to get paid. But then it sort of speaks to this idea of the Olympics. It can't be this amateur thing forever. Given how much money the event generates, how much the IOC suits themselves are paid.
Not Thomas Bach, though. He's officially a volunteer.
Well, a volunteer with an expense account that is probably in the six figures, and that lovely suite at the Palace Hotel in Lausanne.
And an oddity as well, because so many of the IOC staff, well, of course they're paid, they're IOC staff, whether it's in comms, medical, and it can seem slightly odd that officially he isn't paid when it clearly is a full-time job as IOC president. Although maybe it's about trying to maintain this Olympic ideal, as it were, somehow.
Yeah, I think that Seb Coe is not paid either as World Athletics president. I think that's the case.
He needs to get back running again. Win some races,
well,
then.
I mean, to be honest, all these positions, they should get paid, because if they're not, then there must be other ways in which they are rewarded, which I think creates a problem in itself. So I think they should get paid a sort of reasonable salary.
Something, Martin, I found quite interesting was the reaction from other sports, because the Olympics isn't an island just for athletics. 27 have, or 29, I don't know how many now, different sports there. And you know, athletics is obviously the blue ribbon event. Everyone watches it at the Olympics, and it's going to have a decent amount of cash. But then there's other sports that don't. And Sir Steve Redgrave, the multiple gold medal winning British rower, he came out against it, saying, well, you know, there's other sports that will never be able to kind of offer those sort of prizes to their athletes. But, you know, it's and maybe the money that World Athletics is spending on winners should be spent on countries that don't have good athletics programs.
Yeah, that's one of the things, isn't it, that there is an argument that the athletes, of course, are the stars of the show. The IOC makes billions from the TV rights, and without the athletes, the games would be nothing. So should they be paid? But would then that change the whole dynamic of the games, versus all these sports are so reliant on the IOC cash for income to fund their sports all year round. You know, we think of football as being wealthy, they are the Olympic sport that sell a load of tickets, but Think of how many of those sports that wouldn't have the funding without the Olympics. We're not paying attention to lots of world championships of taekwondo, are we, necessarily? Or or hockey. You know, they are quite niche in some ways. They get big attention at the Olympics. So it was one of the arguments for Tokyo. Some people were blaming the IOC, saying, oh, you're only holding the game so you can keep it going on television to get the cash in. But without that cash, a lot of these sports might struggle. So then the question is, if you give cash to athletes right at the top, does that take away from the development of the sport at other levels to encourage participation and growth?
Well, I mean, clearly this, you know, you can, Steve Redgrove say other sports can't afford it. To me, this is clearly SEBCO saying, if I am IOC president, I will make sure the IOC pays the athletes directly. And I think this, they get so much money, they could easily pay the athletes without it affecting materially the amount that they give to the individual sports.
Yeah, and you know that because you've seen how much the staff numbers at the IOC is mushroomed under Thomas Bach and these kind of flights of fancy, if you will, Olympic channel hundreds of millions dollars into that thing, for example. There is money to be spent. There probably is, if they focus on the athletes, money that could be paid to the stars of the games or the people that actually make the games what they are.
But it is part of SEBCO's long marathon, you might say. This is following his own ethos when he was an athlete, clearly disgruntled that he was part of an amateur era. He felt athletes should be paid, and there's all sorts of controversy. In fact, interesting Googling, coming up with things like old New York Times articles talking about some of the complaints, investigations, whether sort of side payments athletes were earning, was a meat paying expenses that were excessive somehow, which effectively served as fees, were there flights around the world that were sort of covering that. And it seems sort of slightly strange to consider it now that, you know, we wouldn't expect an athlete, would we, to compete in what is now Diamond League meat for nothing, would we?
No, and I think times are changing more broadly. If you look at the debate in America over college athletes, for example, who were not allowed to be paid while these programs made millions of dollars, coaches were paid millions of dollars, the broadcast rights were worth billions of dollars. And finally, you've seen college athletes being able to at least sell their image rights and earn some of the recompense for their fame and for what they bring the amateurs, well, the college sports movement.
I mean, interestingly, SEBCO and Thomas Bach were both part of the sort of first, they weren't called an athletes commission, but the kind of group of athletes while they were actually competing in the 1980s who had this sort of discussions with the IOC, which heralded basically the end of our amateurism and in the Olympics and the allowing professional athletes to actually take part in the games. That was a really big step, and they both sort of drove that as athletes themselves, and now they're sort of on the other opposite sides of the fence.
As perhaps at times the IOC and World Athletics were on Russia and their participation in sport, SEBCO becoming someone who was leading the drive to ban Russia over the doping scandal. Thomas Bach and the IOC seeming less rigorous in their action until certainly recently, and calling out Vladimir Putin, attempts to hold these rival games, the friendship games they were being called. I think, rival Olympics, because of course Russia are banned as a team from competing in Paris over the invasion of Ukraine that continues, I think largely down to the fact they've incorporated Ukrainian territory into Russia. But it was just a year ago, we're talking about all sorts of European nations, including Baltics nations and the UK, about being opposed completely to Russians, even as neutrals competing at the Olympics, as well as Belarusians too. But I think, as we discussed heavily at the time, without an or else threatening a boycott, well, it seemed pretty hollow. And now it has sort of crumbled, hasn't it? This challenge against Russia's participation in any form as neutrals, even.
It certainly has, from the British point of view, in the last week. If you remember, Lucy Fraser, the British kind of Department of Culture, Sport and Media Minister, she made a big show, big song and dance about this, hosted a conference, in fact, of 35 countries not so long ago to say it would be ridiculous for Russia to be at the games in any way. And then quietly, in the last weeks, Stuart Andrew, the sports minister, has written to Thomas Bach to say, yes, he agrees some Russian athletes should be at the games. So that was quite an interesting U-turn, and obviously very different to Lucy Fraser, done very quietly and out away from the media gaze.
I was wondering, what is the end game for the British government here? Why are they doing this? Because they were very, very hardline. Suddenly, they seem to be taking a softer approach. How many opportunities have we had to ask Lucy Fraser direct questions about anything around sports policy since she was appointed in February 2023?
Well, I've interviewed a couple of times in recent weeks, I must say. Once, most recently, was at the Oval over a cricket announcement, where we did get into some other issues. You couldn't not ask about other issues, actually including political matters of the day away from sport, because you're in front of a minister. Russia didn't come up that time. I had tried other times, certainly with government officials, and basically getting no obvious updates to that position from a year ago.
Yeah, I think it's because you're a TV person, therefore you're very important, Rob, because if you're a mere written journalist, then there have been zero opportunities to ask any questions to Lucy Fraser, which, I mean, you know, I've been covering sports politics since...
We're not going to wait you, are we? Do you want to?
The year 1925. No, not quite that long. But yeah, certainly since the turn of the century. And I just, it's the lack of access has just been incredible.
To even ask that question. Funny enough, just to go back on something, Rob, those friendship games you mentioned that Vladimir Putin wants to host... He stole a march on Seb Coe as well there. He was offering prize money, decent prize money as well, to winners in each of these sports. And I think, again, yeah, it's kind of rattled Thomas Bach. And, of course, he was caught up with these Russian pranksters we mentioned last week by talking about those games and the fake African Union official who he called on to help him block African nations from appearing at those games. And some more images have appeared, and guys, I don't know if you've seen the image, but you have to wonder. I mean, it was the most cack-handed prank. It was awful. This guy in you know, all blackface is awful, but it was this guy in blackface, obviously looking ridiculous. I think there was a bottle of vodka on the table as well, or somewhere near him. How is it that the IOC president got pranked in such a way and had this long meeting with this man?
Is this the same incident, or is it a separate one from the one we previously discussed?
I think it's the same incident, guys.
No, we're just getting more detail.
It's the same, yeah. But yeah, the detail, the pictures have emerged off the...
It is, and like dripping more info from it.
Yeah, it's like a Zoom call, basically, so... You know, you can actually, which is recorded, so you can see the sort of person who the most, as Tarek says, the sort of most ridiculous sort of get up. You'd have thought, hang on a minute, this person is clearly some sort of hoaxer by the looks of him. Anyway.
Well, he has been talking officially publicly, Thomas Bach. He was in La Keep defending this Olympic opening ceremony plan, the one that's going to be in the open air down the River Seine with the flotilla of boats, with all the athletes parading rather than being in a stadium as usual. And despite all the security threats, he says it's important to have that opening ceremony so they can be open in a divided world. And I was in Paris as this was emerging because I'd gone there for the Champions League game, Paris Saint-Germain, Barcelona, after news of this apparent threat from an Islamic State affiliate. And obviously it raises lots of interesting questions about how we cover such things and as it was sort of unfolding in real time. It was actually the French government who gave it quite a bit of credence and elevated the status of this, didn't they?
Yeah, this was the interior minister who we've heard from several times we've been critical of, Monsieur Darmanin. He famous at the Liverpool Real Madrid Champions League game when he blamed the Liverpool fans for the mess at that final. Turns out it wasn't them. Then he accused Karim Benzema, if you remember, of being a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Benzema said he was going to sue him for that. Now we've got him, you know, having Rob and the others running to Paris to what happened, Rob? What did you do over there?
We were just reporting on the security. There was a lot of reinforcements in terms of policing from around the country. There were, you know, armed officers. We saw SWAT squads that were there on motorbikes, drones overhead. So a heavy police presence. So obviously that one passed off peacefully. But, you know, this emerged from a graphic and various images being posted on IS-affiliated media groups that did purport to threaten the Champions League matches, though to some they were seen as almost like trying to incite people to potentially join the movement and join their cause, rather than being the sort of plots we've seen in the past. And I thought it was surprising UEFA in their statement referred to was it alleged terror threat.
Mm. Well, because it was, well, by the time UEFA's statement came, just to be fair to them, the news was everywhere. It was all over the world. Spanish officials had commented. There was a Real Madrid game on the Tuesday night against Manchester City. Arsenal were playing at home against Bayern Munich and that visual. But, guys, a Champions League game, generally, it's very high profile globally, each of these games, and they're going to have a huge amount of security. I just think the idea that these lads will say, right, we're coming after you. Yeah, we really are, many, many hours before. It was a bit strange, but I assume they're already on very high security alerts for those games, Rob.
Yes, and certainly in Spain, adding officers as well. Although we were both around the Emirates Stadium for their match, weren't we, against Bayern Munich, and maybe it's more the British style. There was no sort of over heavy policing. It was quite regular. Although, of course, there were no Bayern Munich fans because of being banned for fireworks at previous games. So that made it unusual having no away fans.
It did, but they did cheer a couple of goals. I don't know where they showed up. And there were fireworks because it was the night before Eid al-Fitr, the end of Ramadan. And I saw some of the football commentators of the game not realising what those fireworks were about. Made me chuckle. But that part of North London, Finsbury Park, etc., is a big Muslim community, and they were celebrating the coming of Eid.
Yeah, everyone was waiting for it to be officially declared, weren't they?
That's right.
Yeah, it didn't come until Monday, wasn't it, I think, from Saudi Arabia?
Although... weirdly, it's never on the same day all over the world. But that's for another debate and another pod.
Yeah, well, that's the word of UEFA. As we look at FIFA, some news from FIFA this week, all about games being held outside the territories of domestic leagues, something we get used to. We've had the 39th game, that plan, 15 years ago now in England, to hold an additional game in the Premier League season overseas. That fell away amid opposition. La Liga then attempted to take, I think, Classico to the United States, and this latest move was all being launched by a group called Relevant Sports in the United States.
Yeah, and this is by no means irrelevant, Tarek, I think. This has been a court case in the USA. FIFA tried to block La Liga, I think it was, and other leagues playing in the United States. Relevant Sports went to court. What's happened?
Yeah, this is a game that was, if you remember, a few years ago, this was a game that was going to be between Girona's home game, when Girona wasn't this team that might win La Liga, by the way. It was a small team. It was giving away its home game to play FC Barcelona, so a Catalan derby of sorts, in Miami. And that obviously led to where we are today. CONCACAF, the regional body, was fuming. FIFA was fuming, blocked the game, saying it's against FIFA statutes for league games, domestic games, to be played in another territory. And they've been in court ever since. This was going to go to this, and it still might go to the Supreme Court. But FIFA has agreed with Relevant to walk away from its kind of blocking of this. FIFA's council will look at the issue again, and they might even change the statutes to allow games like this. So there could be games overseas. We already had the Spanish Cup, don't forget, the Italian Cup being played in Saudi Arabia in times, but these are league games. And guys, it's not only about the US. If FIFA pulls away from this and changes it, who's a country that you know that's got lots and lots of money that would love to host high profile football matches?
Is it Belgium?
Well, you can certainly see Saudi Arabia being keen on that. And also, countries that struggled perhaps to bring in the revenue, it's an additional revenue stream. And maybe it's not one of the huge countries to start with. If you look lower down the sort of UEFA pecking order of leagues, well, maybe they'd be welcoming of some Saudi cash and you're still bringing recognisable names and teams and some players as well.
Interestingly, about 10 days ago, Casey Wasserman, who is the head of founder of Wasserman Agency and also the head of the Los Angeles 2028 Olympics, he did an interview with a YouTube show in which he said he would be amazed if there was not a Premier League match, proper Premier League match, or La Liga match being played in the USA within the next 10 years. And he is somebody who is, I think, fairly well switched on to all these things.
If you want to get the players on board and some managers, well, he's the agent who oversees quite a few of the big names.
Arteta, yeah. I think. For a start.
Yeah.
Arteta agent backs games abroad.
Yes.
Yeah. The other thing, though, is, if it's the US, I think the audiences are quite sophisticated now as well. They're not just going to watch any game. I don't think, you know, I don't want to, if you're going to say the two lower half of the Premier League teams are going to play against each other, you're not going to fill a stadium in Miami, I don't think.
What, so you mean a team like Chelsea?
Yeah, exactly.
Are they lower half?
But do you see what I mean? How is this going to work in practice as well? I'm thinking
back to the Japanese plan for the 2022 World Cup they never held. They're going to have hologram versions of every game beamed around the world. So maybe that is yet the future, where it's as if you're watching that game in the stadium you're in. It could be in New Jersey, it could be Rio de Janeiro, it could be Lagos, but it's like you're watching the game there.
Yeah, just back to FIFA a second. This quest for... It's very hard to know what they're doing. There's always some new plan or something new happening there. And, you know, we still don't have all the details of this Club World Cup, which is going to be in America in 2025. We don't know where the host cities are, for example.
And also, or indeed the Women's Club World Cup, which has been long in the planning.
Yeah. So, and then you know, you've got this stuff happening. You just wonder, is someone taking charge of all this, or is it just all happening randomly? You feel like, you know, you're just playing pool and you've just broken a game, and the balls are flying all over the place at the moment. It feels a little bit chaotic, that environment.
Pool without the golden ball.
Pool without the golden ball.
The Saudis are planning in Saudi Arabia. Gianni Infantino is at the MLS clubs meeting this week as well in California.
He was, just before he went to South America, Asuncion, for the CONMEBOL Congress there, where it was on YouTube, streamed on there. He was given some sort of golden medallion of some kind, like joining a brotherhood of sorts. There were these fellows all behind him, some sort of friendship with CONMEBOL. Rob, so there were some other announcements of friendship at that event as well, I think.
Yeah, an intriguing agreement between the Israeli FA and CONMEBOL. It sort of talked about potential of Israeli teams competing in club and national team competition. So Israel potentially competing in Copa America, which if we deal with that, wouldn't be as unusual because Qatar played in it in the past, haven't
Qatar,
they?
Qatar, Japan, USA, Mexico. I think one of the Caribbean teams has as well. But this might be part of a broader effort, you know, ahead of the FIFA Congress to get allies, to get support, because we know the Palestinians will probably bring up the issue at the FIFA Congress. Of access to sport and the conflict in the Middle East will be brought up there.
That's what made this announcement intriguing about the club competitions, because although Israel don't qualify for national team competitions, they haven't since the 1972 World Cup. So you can imagine they have their summer spare when, you know, there's a World... Well, obviously, there wouldn't be a Copa America when there's a World Cup, but when there's a Euros, they're not qualifying for it. They reach the playoffs this time. But it's club competitions. They are in the UEFA club competitions. They're in the qualifying stages. They sometimes get Israeli teams in the group stages too. So surely the only way would be to leave UEFA or is this somehow protecting themselves if there was some movement to have them removed from UEFA? There's nothing at all suggesting that at the moment. Of course, they used to be in the Asian Confederation. There were protests there. It led to them eventually joining the UEFA Confederation, what, officially 30 or so years ago.
Yeah, to be honest, I just don't think anything's going to happen. I think it was more a let's make a statement and be seen to have friends, and that's what's happened.
Yeah, I think that strikes me as the most likely way that this has sort of turned out. You're right that this is. I can't see that, you know, the clubs are going to sort of suddenly join the South American championships, or this is very much, you know, we want to show we are not on our own.
Yeah, interesting to see how that does follow up in terms of whether they do play in Copa America. Well, what about the world of the Premier League? We've been talking for several weeks now about the drip feed of club accounts coming in, and there was one we referenced last week was yet to be published. That was Chelsea, and it finally landed at a really convenient time, didn't it?
Yeah, I think 6:30 a.m. Saturday morning is when it went live. I've been sort of waiting for quite a long time because, you know, the deadline to file it in companies else is March the 31st, and, you know, maybe the second class post, you know, so long as you get proof of postage on that 31st, you should be okay. Anyway, it finally came out.
It didn't disrupt your holiday, so you can't complain. You just got home in the nick of time to be woken up at 6:30 with a Chelsea story to write.
Yeah, I was still officially on holiday, but I just thought I'm going to do it anyway because it was a really interesting thing in it.
The Chelsea wage bill, what, £404 million? How does this compare to other clubs then?
Yeah, second highest in the Premier League. They're only the second club ever to go above £400 million, I think. Manchester City, £422 million. But they included sort of obviously some hefty treble bonuses for last season. But the
fourth
more interesting
highest in the world. Fourth highest in the world, Martin, after Barcelona, PSG, Man City, and now Chelsea.
Fourth highest in the world, okay. Mm.
And this was Chelsea's wage bill in a year they didn't win anything. So there's no bonuses. And they didn't qualify for the Champions League or any European competition.
And this was a year they were going to have lower salaries. That was part of the plan. But this was not the most interesting thing in these accounts, was it, Martin?
No, it wasn't. So there was a line in there that in the accounts that they had income of £76.5 million. From selling their two hotels at Stamford Bridge, which reduced their losses to just under 90 million for the year. The year before, it'd been 120 million. Now, reducing these losses effectively, I think, helped enable them to avoid breaching the Premier League's profit sustainability rules. But there was one fairly big issue is that they sold the hotels. Chelsea sold the hotels to a company called Blueco 22 Properties Limited, who just happened to be owned by Blueco Limited, which owns Chelsea. So it's the same people, basically. They just sold it to another company.
How does all this work?
Well, it's just the club claiming an income from selling their hotels to another part of the business.
Right.
It's bizarre. It shouldn't be allowed. The EFL closed this loophole in 2021 because clubs such as Derby and Sheffield Wednesday had sold their stadiums to companies owned by the club's owners. It's ridiculous. So the EFL saw this and closed it. The Premier League put this to the, you know, they didn't actually put it to the vote, but they raised this with the clubs in 2021. Do we want to close this loophole? And the club said no. Basically said no, we're not going to vote on it.
Also, it's an accountancy trick as well, isn't it, Martin? It's moving money from one basket to the other. But also, if you look at Chelsea's statement, they say they had two independent valuers to get this fair market value. And that brings us back to another Premier League rule about related party transactions, which this clearly is. And if it's if it fits within the value that is fair, it counts. And it just got me thinking, well, these people make the rules up for themselves. This is the Premier League clubs have done this. This is within their rules. And we've talked about whether there should be independent regulators and all these things. The Premier League rules are an absolute mess now. They really are. You've got this thing going on. We were talking about it because of the PSR situation. Now, if you're a fan of those clubs that have been hammered, perhaps quite rightly because they've breached the rules, you'd be thinking, well, hang on, well, this doesn't feel right. But these are the rules that the clubs agree with themselves, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
And it just undermines some confidence for some in the rules, doesn't it? Particularly for fans of the clubs who've been on the receiving end of punishments. And of course, we had another punishment for Everton this week. Two more points. They're up to 8 points as their deduction.
Yeah, yeah. And again, no one's spoken about it. Again, this lack of transparency. You've got us trying to work out what things mean. No one fronts any of this stuff up ever.
And there was a column by Richard Masters this week, as well as an advert in, was it Politico, in their newsletter?
There was, but not about this, Martin, Rob. It was about why there shouldn't be an independent regulator. Now, everything that's happened this week might tell you exactly why there should be some better rules, better people regulating it. It was perhaps the worst week possible for this guy to write that, publish that column he did.
I wonder if that was, I don't know, but I wonder if that is because the Premier League clubs are generally anti the regulator. They don't want it. And they employ Richard Masters as the chief executive, and maybe he feels he needs to go public on that. But I think they've got themselves into a real mess by not having a sort of fixed tariff or policy about what happens with if you breach the profit sustainability rules. They've got another mess now over this thing about the, selling to related parties, selling parts of your business to related parties to raise income, which the EFL is much, much better on this. It does have fully sort of transparent. If you breach the rules, you know what you're going to get. I'm sure there's ways clubs can challenge them legally, but it's down there in the rules. And also the loophole about selling your assets to a related parties in the rules. The Premier League really needs to take a leaf out of the EFL's book.
Maybe when you've got 72 clubs, it'd be chaotic if you didn't have some sort of consistent rules. Otherwise, the number of cases could be quite challenging, yeah, particularly when there's sort of all sorts of appeals. But in other spending news, though, this week, we got news of how much agents are earning from Premier League clubs. And perhaps no surprise, top of the table, the only table they are top of, Chelsea. Yeah. £75 million paid to agents and subsidiaries over the last two transfer windows. Premier League's agents spend in total £409.5 million.
Yeah, incredible figures there, Rob. But the Chelsea one, in the accounts, well, they said they spent in that last year £747.8 million on players. That the number you reference in terms of agents' pay is obscene. It's huge. And it equates to how much the club gets in total revenue from its Stamford Bridge Stadium from gate receipts every year. It's more than six of the Premier League clubs spent on transfers in their totality. It's a huge number.
Can't blame the agents, though, if a club's willing to hand that over because they're so desperate to get deals done.
Well, yeah, although I don't have much sympathy or with the agents. I think it was a very sort of... It was a bad day for football when the courts found against... FIFA and the various FAs who are trying to cap agents' fees, because this is huge amounts of money going to basically a few people who are just riding on the backs of players and clubs. I mean, £400 million, that's more than three times the amount that the Premier League has proposed giving to the EFL every year extra in money. It's just going out on agents' fees. And I'm sure they do a good job for their clients, but
it's hard for people to stomach, isn't it? Seeing so much money go out of the game in such a way. And it's very different from agents, particularly dealing with players at the lower end of the game who are struggling to find any club at all or need those sort of moves where the pay isn't as good. It can just seem very large at a time when the Premier League and EFL are at loggerheads over that financial deal, which is at the heart of the regulator that's about to be introduced.
It's really large. Another large number was, Martin, you were asked about it, Man City, 60 million in a summer where they really didn't buy any players, did they? Or it was not the usual Man City spending, but somehow 60 million's gone out the door. Is that because of renewals, or how do you explain that?
I think the most likely thing is that on the agents' fees spending, which is released by the Football Association in England every year, it's when the club pays the money, not when the deal was done. So if you can stagger your payments, I think it's probably very likely this is a lot of that is Erling Haaland's transfer from the season before, where some of the money went out in the first year, some of the money went out to the agents in the second year, and there's nothing to stop that happening.
So what's the next steps? Where are FIFA's agent reforms at then? Or are they just completely blocked by all the legal challenges?
I think they've hit the wall. They have to redraw them, and they're in the process of that. Again, chaos. Rob, what chaos? I talked to you guys about Turkey last week, didn't I?
It's never quiet there, is it? Always no. A sort of dramatic statement. Now what, Fenerbahce, the Turkish Super Cup? Who exactly did they play, or how long did they play for?
Right. It's incredible. We talked about Fenerbahce last week, and I didn't think it'd be possible to top what happened then. Just to remind everyone, that was the vote of the members to leave the league, which they didn't do. But this time, they appeared at the Turkish Super Cup final. Don't forget, that's a game that was delayed. It was going to be played in Saudi Arabia, and then got scrapped with the teams on the way to the stadium in Riyadh after the Saudis said you can't celebrate the centenary of Ataturk and the founding of Turkey. So here we are. So it was Fenerbahce, angry Fenerbahce over what happened in the league with their team being beaten up at Trabzonspor and the rest of it. So they decided to field an under-19 team in that game. They went 1-0 down after 1 minute, Icardi scoring for Galatasaray, and they walked off the pitch. They left the field, and the full stadium was there. So then what do you have? You have Galatasaray getting the trophy and then having a game against their reserves on the pitch because the fans were in the stadium and they wanted them to see something. And then there was a real throat clearer of a statement. It's the only way I could describe it. And it said, it was about over the past 20 years, Fenerbahce has faced various challenges. And then it just went on and on and on. And guys, at this point, this is not a serious place anymore, is it, when it comes to football? It's got such passion for football. It's going to host the Euros in a few years. What's going on there is just insane.
And this was a match that was trying to raise money for victims of the earthquake last year that killed more than 50,000 people.
Yeah, I hope that we won't talk about the next mad episode in Turkey next week. But, you know, there is a good chance we will. I just don't know what's going to happen next there.
Well, didn't expect to be talking about a marathon runner across Tunisia last week, so you just never know what the news will throw up.
No. Oh, by the way, bit of news that happened, and it's kind of tangentially to sports, but big global story. The former NFL player, OJ Simpson, passing away this week.
Yeah, I think moment we'll probably all remember, the moment that verdict came in the case, don't we? Huge television moment.
Yeah, certainly for us. Yeah, it wasn't because this was a murder trial. OJ Simpson accused of murdering his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, her friend Ron Goldman, and that trial, which was preceded by that very slow moving police chase, OJ Simpson in the white van, which I believe is called a Bronco, and he became famous internationally. Obviously. To the rest of us who don't follow NFL. And it was probably because it was the start of the 24-hour TV news era, CNN, Sky News as well, organizations like that. And then the trial was broadcast too.
Yeah, he it was followed by helicopters, wasn't it? Although, of course, some of us knew O.J. Simpson not from his NFL days, but because he was a star of the screen, including Naked Gun. I believe he was
quite right, yeah.
Star of which at the time was one of my favourite shows, favourite films. So yeah, well, he's now no longer with us.
Yeah, died after suffering from cancer. Well, that about brings an end to this week's episode of Sports Unlocked.
Well done, guys. Been really good, Rob. Look forward to seeing who you're racing next week.
I was not running with the horses at the Grand National. We crawled this after that. The huge race, the global race, the world's toughest race, perhaps. But
there's only going to be one winner. Well done. I think those horses are relieved, Rob.
Absolutely. As ever, you can send your thoughts at Sports Unlocked on X, Facebook and Instagram. But for now, thank you for listening. Goodbye.